One question, four expert witnesses. Welcome to The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Our podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Linda.
And I'm Mercy.
With these weird girls.
They don't even sound right.
Before you get to the podcast you've actually chosen to download, we're here to tell you about our new podcast,
Parentland.
It's a podcast for anyone interested in raising children.
The idea is that listeners email in their questions and we use scientific evidence and culture to try and find some answers.
Parentland to the rescue.
We've been having a good old chat about what we're hoping to get from Parentland.
So if you want to hear what we've been talking about, please search for Parentland wherever you find your podcasts.
This is The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, Kavita Puri. Each week, one question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. A three-year-old boy lies silently on a hospital bed in the town of Hajjah in Yemen. He's fighting for breath. His bones are protruding. His father stands over him, watching anxiously. He's already lost a son to the epidemic of hunger. Now he fears his second boy is slipping away. He can no longer buy even a stale piece of bread to feed his family, as prices are rising so fast. That's why, he says, my children are dying before my eyes. This little boy is one of over 10 million people at dangerous risk from starvation in Yemen. The United Nations Secretary General has called it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. But this hunger is man-made. It's the result of 4 years of conflict. Despite the suffering, it's often called the forgotten war. So this week we ask, why don't we care about the war in Yemen?
Part 1. What's the story?
I went to this place on my last trip, and it's this farm that is right outside my grandparents' house. And when we were kids, we used to all play in that piece of land. And there's some goats and chickens, and we used to chase the goats here and play.
Our first expert witness is Nawal Al-Maghafi, a British Yemeni and a reporter for the BBC.
I just saw all these stickers of pictures of martyrs, and they were all children. You know, they looked around 16, 17, 18. And I just thought, you know, it was just the most depressing moment thinking how times have changed.
The martyrs were teenage boys who'd been killed on the front line. The conflict has its origins in the Arab Spring uprising in 2011, which saw the overthrow of the 33-year rule of its leader. A period of transition followed with a new president, Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi. He was supposed to bring stability to Yemen. But 4 years later, Houthi rebels marched to the capital, Sana'a.
It wasn't long before they sent President Hadi out of the country and into Saudi Arabia. And that's when the war broke out, when the Houthis took control of the country.
So it was a coup?
Yeah, it was.
That alarmed Yemen's neighbour, Saudi Arabia. The government decided to take action against Yemen to restore their ally, President Hadi. It called the campaign Operation Decisive Storm.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Good evening, everyone. I'm Adel Al-Jubair, the ambassador of Saudi Arabia to the United States. I wanted to meet with you to inform you that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia launched military operations in Yemen.
A 10-nation coalition led by Saudi Arabia and backed by the UK, the US and other Western countries have been bombing Yemen quite viciously.
Over the last 4 years, many thousands of bombs have been dropped by the Saudi-led coalition and thousands killed as schools, hospitals, weddings, even funerals have been hit. The Saudis have faced strong condemnation from the UN for the heavy civilian casualties. They defend their bombing campaign, saying the Houthis have fired rockets across their border and the Houthi rebels too have been accused by the UN of gross human rights violations.
You have this, you know, horrible fighting on the ground, shelling by the Houthis into civilian areas. They've held two cities under siege.
Why don't we care about Yemen? Why are we not talking about it? Why is it not higher up the news agenda?
People feel completely disconnected. It's an other land that they know nothing about. With Syria, for example, if I was to compare it to the Syria conflict, people have been to Syria for their holidays or have at least been to Jordan or to Lebanon so they can imagine it in their heads. People rarely ever visited Yemen before the war. All they know is these horrifying pictures that we're seeing on the news today.
And for journalists like Nawal Al-Magafi to even report from there, to tell the world what's happening on the ground, is difficult.
Access to Yemen is a nightmare. So, you know, the airports in the northern side of the country have been completely closed down by the Saudi-led coalition. They won't let any civilian flights in and out of there.
And before you even set off, you need permissions to film, which can take months. Firstly, from the government, who is supported by the Saudi-led coalition, just to enter the country. And then,
once you're on the ground, you need to get permission from the different people that are in control, like the Houthis or the other militias. So, yeah, it's incredibly difficult.
To report from around the country is hard. Fighting often happens at night, so you need to travel in daylight hours.
Crisscrossing through mountains and trying to skirt around different front lines. And so it's really, really difficult. And even then, you're passing through different checkpoints manned by different people.
So it's dangerous.
It's very dangerous, yeah.
So getting the story out is risky. And unlike in Syria, she says, there's no tradition of citizen journalism in Yemen. It's a poor country. Few people speak English. And when stories from Yemenis do get out, there's another problem.
Citizen journalism was successful in Syria, but there was a verification process and mechanism to verify that material. I think here, our knowledge is so limited, we find it difficult to verify the material that is coming out of Yemen. The limited material that does come out, it's really difficult to verify it.
But the war in Yemen has received coverage. Nawal Al-Magafi has documented children dying of hunger from lack of medicine and bombing raids, such as one of the largest attacks on a funeral in the capital, Sana'a, 2 years ago.
One of those attending today's memorial event is 14-year-old Hussein.
I'll never ever forget that. There was a first airstrike in this funeral that he was attending, and his leg was stuck under a big rock. The boy cut off his own leg. He said, you know, there was the first strike and I knew a second one was coming. What kind of a world do we live in if a child is thinking that way, that he can knows and can predict how many attacks there will be on a building to the extent that he was willing to cut off his own leg? I just thought, you know, how do you even do that?
Powerful stories. Yet take Britain, one of the countries backing the Saudi-led coalition. A recent poll there said 42% of people had no idea there was even a war in Yemen. One reason, she thinks, might simply be timing.
It's come after so many wars in the Middle East. It's come after Iraq. It's come after all those shocking pictures we've seen coming out of Syria. There's just fatigue, you know. There's only so many pictures of war that you can see, or pictures of starvation that you can see, until, you know, they no longer shock you.
So how the war has been reported and our response to that are reasons why the war in Yemen is a forgotten one. Another is that the situation is very complex. There are no obvious good guys. And importantly, the conflict in Yemen has been confined within its borders.
Part 2. No exodus.
I was visiting a hospital and there was a 6-year-old girl She looked like she could have been two or three, but her face looked very old and wrinkled, and she was not able to smile.
This is Stephen Anderson, who works for the World Food Programme, based in Yemen's capital.
Her family was there with her, and they felt so helpless. And, of course, I've worked in this field for almost 30 years now. But just seeing this on such a tremendous scale, people wasting away, especially children, it's something horrific beyond anything I've seen before.
He says this is the world's largest hunger emergency.
A bit more than 4 years of continuous conflict have brought this country completely to its knees. You have 70% of the country considered to be hungry. 70%. We have 10 million people who are on the brink of famine now.
One of the worst cholera outbreaks in modern history recently broke out in Yemen. He says over 1 million suspected cases were reported. In part, people were unable to resist the disease because they were so malnourished. And the reasons for that?
The prices are soaring about one-third higher than this time last year. And at the same time, people do not have work. You know, most of the civil servants in Yemen have not received or have received only irregularly their salaries. If you include the civil servants with their families, that's 9 million people. So the ability for people to actually purchase food is extremely limited.
But there is another reason for the insecure food supply. Yemen imports 90% of its food, fuel, and medicine, even in normal times, mostly entering the country from two major ports.
Aden in the south, on the Red Sea, there's a port of Hodeidah. These ports are absolutely critical for getting food in, and so we've had a number of setbacks in recent months. We have seen conflict intensify in Hodeidah.
Half of the World Food Programme's aid comes through that port, and it's not just the fighting that can hamper its delivery. Since 2015, a naval blockade has been put in place by the Saudi-led coalition, which has further restricted supplies and driven up prices. Stephen Anderson has been working in humanitarian disaster zones for 30 years and says knowledge about this one is different.
For many of the countries and emergencies I've been involved with, they have a much higher profile. It's a hidden emergency. Most of the world doesn't know what is going on in Yemen. Unfortunately, we're in kind of a bubble.
The bubble is partly due, he believes, to the way the refugee crisis has taken shape.
We've had about 3 million people who've had to flee their homes, and that's a tenth of the population.
So huge numbers of Yemenis have had to flee, but most haven't gone beyond their borders.
What we've seen is really internal movements of people. Most of the people are not living in camps. They're just living with other friends and relatives wherever they find them. Some have told me that they will die within their country.
Do you think that part of the reason that people don't really know about what's going on in Yemen is because it's invisible? A lot of the displacement is happening within the country rather than leaving the country.
Yes, because we do not see an exodus of Yemenis outside the country. They're not landing on boats in Europe or in other parts of the world. This has been one of the contributing factors to making the humanitarian emergency in Yemen much more of an invisible or forgotten one.
So the refugee crisis hasn't touched European shores, as happened as a result of wars in Syria or Iraq. But what of the Yemeni diaspora? Why have they not raised their voices to highlight the suffering in their country?
Part 3. Divided Diaspora.
I've noticed people come out against each other, unfriend each other, slander each other, get into fights on Facebook or Twitter, friends who just aren't speaking and may not be for the foreseeable future. And it's been really, really sad.
This is Dana Moss. She's an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh in America and is writing a book on the diaspora's response to the Arab Spring uprising.
There's been a lot of political divides within the community about which is the right side to be on in this current war.
She's speaking of the divisions within the Yemeni diaspora. And to understand the split, she says, you have to go back into the country's history.
Yemen used to be two countries, the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen and the Yemen Arab Republic. And in 1990, they unified, but then there was a devastating civil war.
The political party from the north won.
And so since then, many southerners feel that they've been discriminated against in terms of resources. They've had peaceful protesters shot. They've been subjected to militarized campaigns of repression.
And she believes the response to the current conflict very much depends on whether you're from the north or south of the country.
A lot of Yemenis are saying, well, the Saudi-led coalition is destroying the country and my family's suffering as a result of that. But if you're in the south and you view, you know, certain sides as helping to liberate the places where your family lives, you might come out on the side of the Saudi-led coalition.
And the views of the diaspora have mirrored those of Yemenis at home.
The diaspora cannot speak with one voice, can they?
It seems not. Unlike in the Syrian case or the Libyan case during the 2011 revolution, we have not seen the diaspora come together to form national lobbies or national level social movements.
And a united diaspora can be a powerful thing, highlighting issues on the ground and even lobbying governments for policy change.
Activists on the ground in Libya were smuggling out information to their contacts in the diaspora. And then the diaspora would translate this information, sort out propaganda from non-propaganda, and forward it on to news sources and to policymakers. I've seen the Syrian diaspora do the same thing. Basically pressured the Obama administration before 2016 not to partner with the Assad regime against ISIS. I mean, this was a major coup done by Syrian American organizations. So diasporas are really key, and when they can get organized, they can be quite powerful. We don't see that from the Yemeni diaspora. That kind of mobilization would have helped the cause a lot.
Why don't we care about the war in Yemen? There's an absence of a unified diaspora to act as an effective voice to lobby policymakers. And if the images of starvation and bombings cannot cut through either, is there anything that can?
Part 4. The Double-Edged Sword.
I fell in love with Sana'a the moment I saw it, really.
Our final witness is Adam Barron, a writer and researcher on Yemen, who's lived in the capital, Sana'a.
The old city is really this jewel box of medieval gingerbread tower houses, streets that haven't changed in 1,500, 1,000 years. There's a real magic about Yemen, and we need to do something before this all slips away.
He says it is difficult to see how Yemen could break through to the public consciousness.
Raising awareness on this is very much an uphill battle.
In part, he believes, that's because Yemen was seen as the ancestral homeland of Osama bin Laden.
Yemen, home of AQAP al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the world's most dangerous al-Qaeda franchise. Yemen, the site of the bombing of the USS Cole. And when these are the associations you have as an American with a country, it's easy to just kind of dismiss it. Oh, you know.
In
2015, President Obama announced he was supporting America's close ally, Saudi Arabia, against the Houthi rebels, though the decision barely made headlines.
I remember being in Washington, D.C. roughly a month after the launch of Decisive Storm. And it was surprising to me, it was interesting to me, the extent that this had not really raised much in the public consciousness. I mean, if you compare it to Syria, Egypt, etc., Yemen just doesn't figure. You know, my friends from college, for example, that are rather educated people, were it not for me, I don't think a lot of them would only be tangentially aware that there's even a conflict going on in Yemen. This is a conflict that the U.S. is part of, that there has been no real discussion about. Why aren't we talking about this?
One reason may be the US as well as the UK are providing intelligence and logistical support to the coalition. And some critics argue they're fueling it by continuing to sell arms to Saudi Arabia.
Western diplomacy is, on the one hand, playing a deeply important role in potentially resolving it. But at the same time, we're also seeing Western arms sales continuing to fuel the conflict. And in the eyes of a lot of American politicians, you know, the arms industry is something that is bringing a great degree of profit, bringing employment.
But concern is starting to grow in some Western capitals. Danish, German, Dutch and Finnish governments have imposed an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia because of human rights concerns over the bombing campaign in Yemen. And Adam Barron says the sale of weapons may end up giving the conflict in Yemen a higher profile.
It's a bit of a double-edged sword. I don't know, it sounds paradoxical, but were it not for the fact that British weapons were being used in this conflict, I think you would see a lot less coverage of it in the British media.
But profit over morality and what the UN is calling possible war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition in its bombing campaign is beginning to pose uncomfortable questions.
This kind of gives journalists and to some extent activists as well something to latch onto in terms of raising kind of consciousness over this conflict.
And do you think that that argument has cut through more than seeing really stark images of children starving?
I think to some extent it has.
Why don't we care about Yemen? It's a complex conflict happening far away. The refugee crisis hasn't hit European coasts, and the Yemeni diaspora has not unified to speak with one voice about the terrible suffering back home. Yet the Saudi-led operation, now renamed, without irony, Renewal of Hope, is being supported by the US, UK and other Western governments, though it may not be something those governments wish to shout about. This is not some distant conflict that has nothing to do with the rest of the world. Western support of the bombing and blockade and its consequences to civilians must surely make us sit up and care about what is happening to the people of Yemen. This inquiry was presented by me, Kavita Puri, and produced by Rosamund Jones. The researcher was Bethan Head. It was mixed by Neil Churchill and edited by Emma Rippon. Our production coordinator is Brenda Brown. And if you like this episode, please do leave us a rating or a comment wherever you get your podcasts.